Much of American history is written about the buildup, the highs. We spend a lot of time in U.S. history on the American Revolution, on the Louisiana Purchase, Manifest Destiny, and Lewis and Clark. We emphasize that there's nothing Americans can't do. We're the greatest country in the world. But somewhere in all that grandeur, we lose the realities of the Great Depression to the story of FDR's New Deal. We lose the terrifying reality of the Cold War to Reagan's Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. We all too quickly have forgotten the brutality of slavery to the end of the Civil War. And of course, why dwell on things that show how fallible we are? Humans are fragile, often bumbling creatures. We make mistakes and we fail. But when given the choice, wouldn't you rather tell the tale of your own glory than one of folly? So when it comes to mining, and the gold rush in particular, it's no wonder that we often think first of the opulence of finding something valuable in the dirt. It's so very characteristically American to see the diamonds in the rough, make something of nothing, find gold in the dirt, bringing value to something that was once seen as worthless. There's a sense of excitement in the story of the gold rush. In North America, it began in North Carolina, in Cabarrus County, just east of Charlotte, in 1799, at what today is Reed's Gold Mine. 30 years later, the Georgia Gold Rush happened in the southern Appalachians. Of course, most notably, the California Gold Rush of 1848 in the Sierra Nevada ignited a national fascination with prospecting for gold. James W. Marshall found gold at Sutter's Mill in Coloma, California on January 24, 1848. The news brought more than 300,000 people to California from the rest of the United States and abroad. When Marshall found a shiny metal in the water wheel of John Sutter's lumber mill, Sutter had the metal tested and discovered it was, in fact, gold. Sutter wanted to keep the news quiet, as he feared what might happen to his plans for an agricultural empire should there be an announcement of found gold and a subsequent flux of prospectors. Soon, the rumors of discovered gold were confirmed by Samuel Brannan, a San Francisco newspaper publisher, in March of 1848. Brannan, being a savvy businessman, soon set up a store to sell gold prospecting supplies. He then walked through the streets of San Francisco, holding a vial of gold and screaming, "Gold, gold, gold from the American River."
"Gold! Gold! Beautiful gold!"
By August 19, 1848, the New York Herald announced to the East Coast the discovery of gold, and by December 5, 1848, President James Polk confirmed the discovery of gold in an address to Congress. It was now nationally known information. Of course, with this news, and much to Sutter's chagrin, the so-called 49ers began moving to the Gold County of California in search of striking it big. The 1849 gold rush stimulated worldwide interest, and those who couldn't make it to California began searching closer to home. Gold rushes boomed in Australia, South Africa, Wales, and Scotland. Simultaneously, gold rushes were booming in North America, including British Columbia, as well as the states of Nevada, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, New Mexico, Alaska, and Colorado. The Rocky Mountains proved fruitful for mining. In Colorado, gold had been mapped as long ago as 1758 by Antoine Simon Lepage de Prats, who mapped a source of gold north of the Arkansas River, but it was said his map was clouded with so much doubt and uncertainty that no dependence could be placed upon it. In the early 1800s, gold was noted to be in the South Park districts by Pike, though Pike himself questioned his findings. And in the noise of the California Gold Rush, a member of the John C. Fremont mapping expedition was said to have found gold in the Lake City area. And by the 1850s, gold was found in the Denver area by Cherokee prospectors en route to California. Gold has since been mined in the state of Colorado as late as 2008. Colorado will be the focus of our episode today, specifically St. Elmo, Colorado, once a mining town, booming with the discovery of gold and silver. But rather than focusing on the boom, what about the bust? What happens when the mines run dry, and what was once a thriving town has been exploited for all it can give? What remains are often the skeletons of the past, a place that one can quite literally walk through yesteryear, feeling the grit under their feet and the tug to another time.
there are more dead towns in Colorado than there are live ones.
I'm Nikki, and this is Tales of Two Cities.
Hello.
Welcome.
This is Tales
of Two Cities.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Hello, and welcome back. Thank you all for your patience as we took a short summer hiatus. Things have been crazy. I finished my PhD in June and moved to, you guessed it, Colorado. So be prepared for all of the spooky, strange, and weird stories from the Centennial State, starting with the tale of St. Elmo.
There are hundreds of ghost towns, either preserved or undiscovered, throughout Colorado.
Prospectors went where the gold was, or the silver. And these weren't places where towns were supposed to be.
But it sure is beautiful, so you can't blame them for wanting to live there.
And they often worked really hard and really fast to try to be a respectable town. You could see civilization was taking hold.
These are the origin stories of settlement and civilization in Colorado.
In 1878, in the heart of the Sawatch Range in southwest Colorado, a small town was settled. 1879 brought the decision to develop Chalk Creek Canyon by both Denver South Park and the Pacific Railroad. The goal was a tunnel through the Continental Divide to Gunnison, Colorado. The track would serve Aspen and Glenwood Springs, as well as serve local mines and transport freight over Tin Cup Pass. It's believed Dr. Abner Ellis Wright was one of the earliest prospectors to come to the area, as early as 1871. He came to Chalk Creek with long hair to cover where his ears should have been. Wright is believed to have lost his ear to a grizzly bear in California in March of 1850. The bear took his ear, a part of his rib, and caused a deep sinking of his chest, which when healed, had left a gnarly scar. He also had a large depression in his skull. Wright was a tough dude. He had returned to the United States after having walked from Nicaragua on foot. He fought in the Civil War for 3.5 years before moving to Chalk Creek. He believed to be the first to discover the precious metals in what would become the Mary Murphy Mine. Being a smart businessman, he sold the claim to a St. Louis company in 1880 for $75,000. He moved to nearby Buena Vista and began practicing medicine there as he had graduated from Alloys Medical College years before in 1836, when he was just 20 years old. Despite Wright having recognized the immense value to resource extraction, it was actually businessmen Griffith Evans and Charles Seitz who recognized the potential of the area for development. The two men hired a surveyor in spring of 1880 to plan Forest City. The name had been taken by a town in California and was changed to St. Elmo, which happened to be the name of a novel by Augusta J. Evans, which was popular at the time. The small mining town is 20 miles outside present-day Buena Vista. Nearly 2,000 people settled here when the mining for gold and silver began. St. Elmo was built so quickly, it is said to have been laid out in 6 feet of snow. The Denver Tribune stated, quote, "St. Elmo, a town of less than 6 months, has 2 sawmills, a smelter, and a concentrator, 3 hotels, 5 restaurants, and several stores." A vocation survey found mining engineers, doctor, surveyor, blacksmith, attorney, carpenters, assayer, jeweler, saloon keeper, hotel proprietor, and more in St. Elmo. The American House Hotel was built in 1880 by E.P. Whitney. Whitney was originally a farmer in Maine, but he worked as a hotel proprietor as he worked his way west before settling in St. Elmo to build the American House Hotel. He completed the building and added a 2-story addition with a store and parlor in 1882. But he died just a year later at 66 years old. His widow managed the hotel until 1885, giving visitors a place to stay as they passed through the town. While St. Elmo began with a high moral character, it didn't take long for the character of a typical mining town to take over. Soon, the predominantly single male population spent time in many saloons, dance halls, and brothels. Within 10 years, the town offered more than mining necessities, including a telegraph office, a general store, town hall, 5 hotels, a newspaper, and a schoolhouse. The town also boasted the Denver, South Park, and Pacific Railroad lines. In January of 1881, a rail station was built in St. Elmo. Tracks were then built to Romley, Hancock, and through the historic Alpine Tunnel, cutting through the Continental Divide. St. Elmo was considered the main source of supplies arriving by train for the settlers in the area. In the same year, Anton Stark, a cattleman, brought a herd to the railroad. He was so fond of St. Elmo that he quickly brought his family to settle. He became a section boss for a local mine, and his wife ran a general store and the 16-room Home Comfort Hotel. Later, the buildings would become the post office and the telegraph office. The family flourished. The couple raised three children, Tony, Roy, and Annabelle. The kids helped with the store and the hotel. The hotel was known to be the cleanest in town, with the best meals, while the store was known to have the biggest supply and highest quality goods. The town was really building up, but the mines were the core of the town, with 150 patented mine claims within the area. The majority of the population of St. Elmo worked in the mines. The Mary Murphy, Teresa C., the Molly, and the Pioneer Mines were the most prominent. Mining created a large profit for those who were managing them. It didn't take long before the Starks got in on some of the profit, and soon they became a part of the St. Elmo elite. These residents were high class, regular churchgoers, and regimented people. Anna, for example, was said to be a humorless woman who controlled her children with an iron fist. Rumors swirled that she believed her family to be better than the other townfolk, meaning the miners, railmen, prostitutes, and others. The Stark children were rarely allowed to leave their home and were forbidden from the town dances or social activities. By 1883, there were 50 producing mines in St. Elmo, and by 1885, the initial wave of mining was subsiding. Many of the initial successful prospectors were now moving on. Merchants became the heart of the town, and false fronts were added to the buildings on Main Street, as they were now the core of the town's economy. The Mary Murphy Mine remained successful, though, through the early years of St. Elmo and picked up again in 1888, ending the decade in an economic boom. But the highs and lows of St. Elmo continued. Winters were tough, as the town is at a high elevation and is isolated. The Alpine Tunnel was the lifeline of St. Elmo to the other towns, but frequently was inaccessible. The tunnel, which was supposed to take 6 months to create, took 2 years. They had to cut 3 miles into the mountainside of Alton Pass. Throughout the 1880s, the railway was only profitable by carrying freight, as few passengers took the rail. And in February of 1890, the railroad closed the Alpine Tunnel due to heavy snow. But it remained closed for 5 years. There was a subsequent drop in the economy. St. Elmo was falling on hard times already. And just a few months later, in April, following the theme for the turn of the century towns, listen to our previous episodes if you don't know this, a fire destroyed much of the business section of the town.
Most of the town burned at some point or another.
What started on the west side of Main Street, likely in the kitchen of the Clifton Hotel, quickly engulfed the entire block. The town was never rebuilt to its original expanse. The fire meant many business owners picked up and moved on, cutting their losses and finding new places elsewhere to start over. But, true to the town's enduring nature, the passing of the Sherman Act in 1890 brought hope. The Sherman Act doubled the amount of silver purchased by the government, creating a boom in mining. Soon, 3 new ore mills were built at the Mary Murphy, the Pat Murphy, and the Pawnee Mill. This was also the time that St. Elmo's population peaked. Around 2,000 residents filled the streets. Though by 1893, the Sherman Act was repealed. This, coupled with the Panic of 1893, a serious economic depression in the United States, silver prices plummeted and many mines closed. Even so, mining remained the backbone of the town's industry and economy. There was a shift from silver to gold mining, and miners began to leverage new techniques for processing low-grade ore. The Mary Murphy Mine was the largest and most profitable mine in the area. Mary Murphy alone recovered over 60 million worth of gold while in operation. By 1895, the railroad was under new management, and the Alpine Tunnel was reopened. The new manager had hoped tourism would offset the decrease in freight revenue. But in 1895, another fire hit St. Elmo. This time, the east end of Main Street was set ablaze, and the fire hydrants, installed following the 1890 fire, were frozen in the January cold. The aftermath of the fire is how we see the town today. Even though the town was hit with many setbacks, St. Elmo residents were still flourishing. During these years, people remained optimistic about mining. They were politically active. There was a mayor and a board of trustees to manage the town, and the population remained active in other ways, such as serving on the school board. The town's schoolhouse held regular classes and doubled as a church for traveling preachers. Though a finite resource, mines were depleted and miners moved to work elsewhere. By 1910, so many mines had failed that the Alpine Tunnel was closed, and this was the beginning of the end. There was a small mining boom during the First World War, one that would help restore hope for St. Elmo residents, but only for a time. Mines continued to close, and the railroad petitioned to discontinue service in the early 1920s. By that time, the Mary Murphy was the only mine that remained in operation. The railroad was no longer profitable. The town resisted the decommissioning of the line. They said that closing the line was a death sentence for the town. The case was so contentious that it went to the Supreme Court in a 4-year legal battle, though the Supreme Court sided with the railroad. The story goes that in 1922, the last train out of St. Elmo carried the town's entire population, leaving it a ghost town, skeletal remains of buildings with no blood or breath. While poetic, the town population decreased quickly, but not immediately. Miners left in search of the next mining town to find gold or silver. And of course, other businesses in St. Elmo were affected. Many closed. Very few people stayed in St. Elmo. St. Elmo felt the boom, and now it was the bust. But the Starks held tight to St. Elmo. For years, the Stark boys, Roy and Tony, tried to convince developers to reopen mines, but they were denied again and again. They turned to tourism, leasing cabins to vacationers, and continued to run the general store. After her husband's death, Anna realized that tourism was not entirely fruitful. She sent her daughter Annabelle to nearby Salida, 20 miles north of St. Elmo, to work in a telegraph office. Annabelle finally had some freedom. She'd often referred to St. Elmo as a prison made by her mother. Though in Salida, she was without her oversight. She met a young man named Irvin Ward and married him in 1922. She sent a telegram to her family that she was moving to Trinidad, Colorado. And what happened to Annabelle after she left St. Elmo is contested. Some stories say she disappeared for 2 years and, without explanation, returned to St. Elmo, divorced, where she spent the rest of her life. Though in town, much of the information on Annabelle says that she returned to St. Elmo many years later, around the time of her mother and brother's deaths, to help. Irvin had died in a railway accident in 1926. The town presents an image of Annabelle as having had a successful marriage, marred by tragedy, and her heroically returning to home to help her brother continue the family business. The Mary Murphy mine closed in 1925. From 1870 to 1925, it produced 220 ounces of gold, worth $4.4 million at the time. With the closure of the Mary Murphy mine, mining was officially done in the town. And in 1926, the railroad tracks were torn up to make way for a road. The town was all but abandoned, though the Stark family stayed. Perhaps too optimistic, or truly in search of regaining their elite status, the Starks stood loyal to St. Elmo. The Stark family began buying property at tax sales and acquiring much of the town. The three children and their mother maintained the town by running the general store and by renting cabins, many acquired in tax sales to tourists. Though alone, it was hard to maintain the town. In 1930, the population of St. Elmo was just 7. And in 1934, Roy passed away, and his mother died a short time later. The only residents left were Annabelle and her brother Tony. What, for a time, was a mother and her sons became a brother and sister. Together, they lived in the dead town, without indoor plumbing or electricity. The two rarely bathed or changed clothes. They neglected the old hotel, letting trash pile up. The two did continue to run the home comfort store. The store was said to smell sour, containing nothing more than expired canned food and stale tobacco. Because of their shabby appearance, those who passed through the town began to call Annabelle Dirty Annie. She had dirty clothes, tangled hair, and smelled unwashed. She was known to roam the town with a shotgun in hand to protect her property. If the town had a heartbeat, it had been weak for a long time. Though in 1952, it flatlined. An official time of death was established with the death of the postmaster and the ensuing closure of the post office.
A ghost town in the interior west, including Colorado, is a place where a lot of people arrived, started building things, had ambitions, and they often worked really hard and really fast to try to be a respectable town. And then, with all that effort and aspiration, it didn't work.
Tony Stark had died, and it was now only Annabelle Stark. Alone in the now dead town, Annabelle was eventually sent away to an institution for the mentally ill, for her own safety, though more likely for the safety of others. A sympathetic friend convinced authorities just a few weeks later to release her. She was sent to a nursing home in 1958, and she died just 2 years later. All the property was left to Marie Skogsberg, who had been the dear friend that convinced them to release her from the institution. Marie worked to maintain the roofs and lease the cabins that were available. When Marie died, she left it all to her daughter, Betty Millam, and her family, who began an effort to preserve, not just maintain, St. Elmo's remaining buildings. In 1979, the town was registered as a National Historic District, and in 1985, windows were unboarded and repaired so that visitors may look inside. In 1992, the Pawnee Black Shop and the livery stables were restored. Buena Vista Heritage continues to work for money to restore buildings and preserve historic St. Elmo, though improvements to the town and newly found celebrity wasn't well received. In April of 1993, the New York Times called St. Elmo one of the country's best preserved ghost towns, representative of what an early 20th century mining town would look like. Though, one resident responded, explaining that the kind of people that move to St. Elmo don't live there for the booming tourism industry and increasing population. Actions were taken to ensure that visitors stayed out of private property and better respected the residents of the ghost town. Today, St. Elmo is considered a ghost town still, but is inhabited. Many tourists visit the town, and the former mining roads are often used for off-roading. People recreate on trails nearby, fish in Chalk Creek, which runs through the town, and the general store remains open in summer. While many buildings have been destroyed by time and the fire in 2002, others still remain. The 2002 fire began in the town hall. It spread quickly to the Stark duplex, Borough Barn residence, and Annabelle's garage. The fire, in all, burned down town hall, part of the Stark complex, a historic flagpole, telephone booth, and several privies. All of the buildings, except Annabelle's garage, dated back to the 1880s. Some believe the 1985 classic, St. Elmo's Fire, was a prophecy for the fire. Buena Vista Heritage is rebuilding the town hall and some other buildings in town. Today, St. Elmo is still known as one of Colorado's best preserved ghost towns. So of course, I went to St. Elmo. I had to see what it was all about. It was a 3-hour drive from home, and on the stormy summer afternoon, the drive felt ominous. As we drove further west, the clouds grew thicker, and by the time we turned toward the mountains, the sun, once dodging the clouds, was now totally lost. The darkness was broken by the occasional flash of lightning, followed by the booming rattle of thunder. The rain came in cycles, first small specks on the windshield, then big drops, then blindingly heavy rain, my wiper blades throwing it off as quickly as possible, but the glass almost immediately becoming covered again. I'd left Denver in almost 90-degree heat, with blue sky and some scattered puffy clouds. 2 hours later, I was in the middle of nowhere, southern Colorado, driving towards a ghost town. The mountain pass brought hope. In the far distance, I could see white clouds surrounded entirely by the dark, heavy rain clouds. I thought, I hope that's where we're going. The rain lessened, but the sky stayed dim and heavy. Soon, we passed through one small town after another, and then the GPS said to turn off onto another small road. We were just 15 miles away now. We were, in fact, moving toward the lighter patch of sky. But the road was narrow, and soon the concrete ended. The trees were thick, thick enough that you get the feeling that there's nothing beyond them but more trees. We took the dirt road for 7 more miles before turning a corner and seeing ruins, the foundations of buildings, a chimney, and then St. Elmo. There are many tales of haunting in St. Elmo. The major player is Annabelle, though in my research, it was hard to know which stories to believe. There's always three sides, right? Yours, mine, and then the truth. What I found in both my research and time at St. Elmo is there is two faces to this town, the boom and the bust, or perhaps the romantic and the brutal. Some say that Annabelle never left St. Elmo until her death in 1960. Others, of course, say that she left when she was married. Again, some say her marriage was short-lived. Others think that she only came home following her brother and mother's deaths. Much of the Stark legend online tells of a sad end for the family. Brother and sister attempt to maintain family legacy, but fall into shambles, dirty and angry. Annabelle walks the streets of St. Elmo with a rifle, and with the help of her brother, guards the town that everybody but them had left. It ends with them being institutionalized, but St. Elmo tells a different story, painting both Annabelle and her brother as heroes who help maintain the town, protecting it from decay and ensuring the history be kept alive for future generations. Three sides to a story, but the truth is harder to find. Regardless, it is known that Annabelle Stark loved St. Elmo. Some say that after her death, Dirty Annie's beloved hotel had to be thoroughly cleaned as there was decades of dirt and stuff piled high. In the process of cleaning, it's been said that cleaning supplies were moved out from their padlocked closet and left in the center of the room, perhaps to make Annabelle's presence clear, or perhaps she was displeased. More than once, the image of a ghostly woman has been seen in the hotel. The first sighting was in the late 1970s, when someone saw her peering from an upstairs window. After seeing the woman, the person saw snowmobiles coming towards them. They went to let them know that they weren't allowed in the town. And when they looked back, the woman was gone. They searched the room where she had been seen, and there was nothing and no one. Another story tells of a skier who had a similar experience. Saw an attractive woman in a white dress in the second story window of the hotel while skiing down Poplar Street. In this story, it was only one snowmobile heading into town. The skier watched the woman's eyes follow the snowmobile. He went over and told them that snowmobiles were not allowed in St. Elmo. And as the man in the previous story had, the skier then looked up at the window. He nodded to her, and she turned away from the window and vanished. The hotel manager was out of town. No one was in the building. So who, other than Annabelle, could it have been? When I was in St. Elmo, I paid close attention to all the windows. But alas, nothing. Another story tells of the grandchildren of the friend that Annabelle left the town to. While cleaning the hotel, the grandchildren were playing in a room, and suddenly, all the doors slammed shut. The temperature dropped rapidly. It so thoroughly terrified the children that they refused to play in the hotel again. Haunted or not, St. Elmo remains exciting. In 2015, explosives were found in an outhouse. They turned out to be blasting caps, old blasting caps, which are more dangerous as they're less stable. A bomb squad came and removed them. Crisis was averted. And while most of the news about St. Elmo today focuses less on the supernatural and more on the historical importance of this small town, there was just one thing that I couldn't shake after my visit. In a window of one of the abandoned houses was a short article. You see, because the wooden grave markers traditionally used in burials were lost to weather, vandalism, or time, many grave sites are now left to conjecture. So you see, in St. Elmo, you don't really know where the bodies are buried. The history remains contentious between family friends and supernatural sleuths. The buildings are being renovated. The town is getting a new face. And with restoration comes a new story of a town that was critical to the mining boom in the Rockies. Though one must wonder, what is the true story of St. Elmo? One of glory, splendor, resilience, boom, or just bust? Thanks for listening. We appreciate each one of you being so patient as we took a much needed summer hiatus. But we're back, new episodes every 2 weeks. And in October, we'll be doing our annual Halloween marathon of minis. 8 episodes in October, coming so soon. We love hearing from you, so hit us up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or email us at talesoftwocitiespodcast@gmail.com. That's talesoftwocitiespodcast@gmail.com. And please, rate, review, and subscribe on the listening platform of your choice. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Spotify. We're a bi-weekly podcast, but if you just can't wait for the next episode, head over to our Patreon and pledge for mini episodes and bonus content. And never forget, we have merch! So head to TeePublic and check out some of our badass sales on merch. Again, we appreciate each of you. Thanks for listening. Until next time.